longer, longer. She felt the moment of the sun's union with the earth, its first touch upon the line of hills, audible, like a sigh. She closed her eyes and sent her mind diving into darkness. The ripples widened on the lake's tranquil surface high above. Anthony, I'm here. First, silence. Then, yes, Amy. They are ready. They are yours. Night was falling. Come to me, she thought. Night fell. 72. They were called dopeys, but in their lives they had been many things. They hailed from every quarter of the continent, every state and city. Seattle, Washington, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mobile, Alabama, the toxic chemical swamp of New Orleans and the windswept flatlands of Kansas City and the ice-bound canyons of Chicago. As a body, they were a statistician's dream, a perfect representative sampling of the inhabitants of the great North American empire. They came from farms and small towns, faceless suburbs and sprawling metropolises. They were every color and creed. They had lived in trailers, houses, apartments, mansions with views of the sea. In their human states, each had occupied a discreet and private self. They had hoped, hated, loved, suffered, sung, and wept. They had known loss. They had surrounded and comforted themselves with objects. They had driven automobiles. They had walked dogs and pushed children on swing sets and waited in line at the grocery store. They had said stupid things. They had kept secrets, nurtured grudges, blown upon the embers of regret. They had worshipped a variety of gods, or no god at all. They had awakened in the night to the sound of rain. They had apologized. They had attended various ceremonies. They had explained the history of themselves to psychologists, priests, lovers, and strangers in bars. They had, at unexpected moments, experienced bolts of joy so unalloyed, so untethered to events, that they seemed to come from above. They had longed to be known, and sometimes almost were. Heirs to the viral lineage of Anthony Carter, 12th of 12, they were intrinsically less bloodthirsty than their counterparts. It had been remarked many times by human observers that the dopeys satisfied their appetites with an attitude of joyless obligation, and that it was this characteristic, singular among virals, that made them easier to kill. Dumb as a dopey was the phrase. This was true, while also concealing a deeper truth. Indeed, they did not like it. The butchery of innocence disturbed them. Yet within them lay an unexpressed ferocity, unwitnessed by humankind. For more than a century they had waited, anticipating the day when the call would come to release this hidden power. In their lives, they had been many things. Then, they were another. Now, they were an army. First in twilight, then in blackness, beneath the Texas stars, they roared west, a wall of noise and dust. At the head of the pod, like the point of a spear, a pair of riders led the way. For Alicia, the sensation was one of pure momentum. She was leading as much as she was being led, joined to a primal force. For Amy, the feeling was one of expansion, an internal amassing of souls. The moment Carter had surrendered his forces to her command, they had ceased to be external entities. They had become extensions of her awareness and her will. Her many. Come with me. Come with me, come with me, come with me. Ahead, like lights upon a distant shore, the besieged city appeared. Weapons up! All along the catwalk, the snap of magazines, the clack of bolts, rounds hammering into chambers. The last shadows were gone, drowned in the gloom. It didn't take long. A glowing line appeared to the east. Second by second it thickened, spreading over the land. A feeling of fate, of destiny. It hung like a fog. The city seemed meager in its face. "Here they come!" The horde rumbled toward them. Its speed was tremendous. Random shots split the air. Men adrenalized with terror who could not restrain the urge to fire their weapons. Peter pressed the radio to his mouth. "Hold your fire! Wait till they're in range!" The stars were disappearing, blotted out by the great dust cloud that ascended in the viral's wake. The pod had taken the form of an arrow-like wedge. "Looks like the negotiation phase is over," Apgar said. More panicked shots. The pod kept coming. They would drive straight through the gate, splitting it like a bullseye. "Hang on a second," Apgar said. He was watching through binoculars. "Something's off. What are you seeing?" He hesitated, then said, "They're moving differently. Short leaps, long strides in between, like the older ones do." He pulled the lenses away. "I think these are dopeys." Something was happening. The pod was decelerating. From the spotting platform, a cry went up. "Riders! 200 yards! "Prepare yourselves." Amy slowed Soldier to a canter, then a trot. "We will defend this city. We will hold this gate, my brothers and sisters of blood." Flowing like a liquid, her forces spread. Amy moved among them. She dared not show fear. Her courage would be theirs. She rode with her back erect, Soldier's reins held lightly in one hand, the other extended in a gesture of blessing, like a priest. "They were people once, like you. But they follow another, the Zero." 1,000 long, 300 deep, Amy's forces formed a protective barrier along the northern wall and turned to face the field. To the east, the first edge of moon was peeking above the hills. "Do not hesitate, for they will not. Kill them, my brothers and sisters, but always with a blessing of mercy in your heart." She felt the eyes of the soldiers upon her, the posts and crosshairs of their guns. The great dust cloud was settling. A taste of grit was in her mouth. "Stand tall. Have courage. Show him who and what you are." They brought their horses to a halt at the front of the line. Amy removed the pistol from her belt, passed it to Alicia, and drew the sword from over her back. The grip possessed a satisfying thickness, comfortable in the hand. She rocked her wrist to turn its blade in the air. "This is a fine weapon, sister. I was sort of guessing when I made it." Her mind was composed, her thoughts ordered and calm. There was fear, but also relief, and on top of this, curiosity about what would come. "I've never gone into battle," she said. "What is it like?" "It's very busy." Amy considered this. "Things happen fast. You won't even be aware of them until later. Most will seem like they happened to somebody else." "I suppose that makes a lot of sense." Then, "Alicia, if I don't survive, one other thing." "What's that?" Alicia met her eye. "You're not allowed to say things like that." On the rampart, chaos reigned. Runners were dashing, fingers were twitching on triggers. Nobody knew what to do. "Hold fire? They're virals! And why are they facing the wrong direction?" "I mean it," Peter barked into the radio. "All stations, stand down now!" He tossed Apgar the radio and turned to the closest runner. "Private, get me a harness." "Peter, you are not going out there," Apgar said. "Amy can protect me. You can see it for yourself. They're here to defend us."
I don't care if they're here to fix the plumbing. You've lost your goddamn mind. Do not make me tackle you, because I will absolutely do that.
The soldier darted his eyes to Peter, then the general, then back again.
Sir, should I get the harness or not?
Private, you take one step and I'm going to pitch you over that wall,
Apgar said. Another cry from the spotter.
We have movement. The riders are moving away.
Peter looked up.
What do you mean away?
A face floated over the rail, a quick conferral with someone behind him, then the man pointed due north.
Across the field, sir.
Peter stepped back to the edge of the rampart and raised his binoculars.
Gunner, are you seeing this?
What are they doing?
Apgar said.
Are they surrendering?
With a puff of dust, Amy and Alicia brought their horses to a halt. Amy drew and raised the sword. It was not a gesture of capitulation, but defiance. They were setting themselves as bait.
Fanning, do you hear me?
Amy's words dwindled into the gloom.
If you want me, come and get me.
Should we go further out?
Alicia asked. If we do, we might not make it back. Then raising her voice again,
are you listening? I'm right here, you bastard.
Alicia waited, still nothing. Then,
you have done well, Alicia.
She pressed her hands over her ears, a pointless reflex. Fanning's voice was inside her.
Everything I could have wished for, you have accomplished. Her army is nothing. I can whisk it away. You have given me that, and so much more.
Shut up. Leave me alone.
Amy was staring at her.
Lish, what is it?
Is it Fanning?
Do you feel it, Alicia?
Fanning's voice was smooth, taunting. It was like an oily liquid spreading through her brain.
Of course you do. You always could. Haunting the streets, counting heads. They are a part of you as I am a part of you.
Alicia heard the sound then. No. Not heard. Sensed. A kind of scratching. Where was it coming from?
She must come to me in ruins. That will be the truest test. To feel what I feel. What we feel, my Alicia. To know despair. A world without hope. Without purpose, everything lost.
Alicia, tell me what's happening.
I know your dreams, Alicia. The great walled city and its sounds of life within. The music and the happy cries of children. Your longing to be among them and the door you cannot enter. Did you know even then, Alicia? Did you know what lay in store?
The sound grew more intense. The blood was throbbing in her neck. She thought she might be ill.
My Alicia, it is already done. Can you feel it? Can you feel them?
Her mind slammed back to awareness. She turned in her saddle. Beyond the barrier of Amy's army, the lights of the city shone.
Outside, she thought. I'm outside, just like in the dream.
Oh, God, no.
Sarah was trying to make herself breathe. 120 souls were crammed in the basement. Candles and lanterns spread throughout the space, cast odd, animated shadows. Sarah's pistol lay in her lap, her hand upon it, loose but ready. Jenny and Hannah had organized a game of duck-duck-goose to distract some of the children. Others were occupying themselves with smuggled toys. A few were crying, though probably they did not know why. They were channeling the anxiety of the adults. Sarah was sitting on the floor with her back against the door. Its metal face was cool against her skin. Would it hold? Various scenes unfolded in her mind. Pounding on the door, the metal bulging, everyone screaming, backing away, then the final crack and death pouring in, engulfing them all. She was watching Jenny and Hannah. Jenny was terrified. The woman wore her emotions like a coat. But Hannah had a steady streak in her. It was she who had initiated the game. There were people, Sarah knew, who were like this, the ones who could not be ruffled or else didn't show it, who possessed great internal reservoirs of calm. Hannah was racing around the circle on her long legs, grinning with conspiracy, pursued by a little boy. Hannah was going to let him catch her, of course. She made a stagey show of her surrender that sent the boy into a fit of happy giggles, which for a moment put Sarah at ease. She remembered such games, how much fun they were, their object so simple and pure. She had played Duck Duck Goose as a girl, then later with Kate and her friends. But in the next instant, this thought was replaced by another. Kate, she thought. Kate, where are you? Where have you gone? Your body lies in a bed far from home. Your spirit has flown. I am lost without you. Lost. Dr. Wilson, are you okay? Holding Carlos, Grace was standing above her. Sarah touched her tears away. How's he doing? He's a baby. He doesn't know anything. Sarah made a place beside her. Grace lowered herself to the floor. Are we going to be safe here? Grace asked. Sure. A silence. Then Grace shrugged. You're lying, but that's okay. I just wanted to hear you say it. She turned her face toward Sarah. You were the one who transferred your birthright to my parents, weren't you? I guess they told you. Just that it was the doctor. I don't see any other women doctors around the place, though, so I figured it had to be you. Why did you do it? There was probably an answer, but Sarah couldn't think of it. It just felt like the thing to do. My folks were good to me. Things weren't easy, but they loved me as well as anyone could. We always said a prayer for you at supper. I thought you should know. From baby Carlos, a yawn. Sleep was near. For a minute or so, Sarah and Grace watched the game together. Suddenly, Grace looked up. What's that noise?
Station 6, we have movement. Peter grabbed the radio. Say again? Not sure. A pause. Looks like it's gone now.
Station 6 was at the south end of the dam.
Everyone maintain readiness, Apgar yelled. Hold your positions!
Peter barked into the mic.
What are you seeing?
A crackle, and then the voice said,
Forget it, I was wrong.
Peter looked at Chase. What's below Station 6?
Just scrub.
Enough for cover?
Some.
Peter took up the radio again.
Station 6, report. What did you see?
I'm telling you, it's nothing, the voice repeated. Looks like just another sinkhole opening up.
From his post on the roof of the orphanage, Caleb Jackson did not hear the sound so much as feel it, a disturbance lacking a discernible source, as if the air were bristling with a swarm of invisible bees. He scanned the city with his binoculars. All seemed ordinary, unchanged. Yet, as his mind stilled, he became aware of other sounds, coming from several directions. The crack of wood splintering, the crash and tinkle of fracturing glass. A rumble, lasting perhaps 5 seconds, of an unknown type. Around him, and on the ground below, some of his men had begun to sense these things as well. Their conversations halted, one man or the other saying, Do you hear that? What is that?
Eyes burning from lack of sleep, Caleb peered into the darkness. From the roof, he had a clear view of the Capitol building and the city's central square. The hospital was 4 blocks east. He unhitched his radio from his belt. Hollis, are you there? His father-in-law was stationed at the entrance to the hospital.
Yeah.
Another crash. It came from deep within the streets of the city. Are you hearing this? A gap. Then Hollis said,
Roger that.
What are you seeing? Any movement?
Negative.
Caleb brought his binoculars to bear on the Capitol. A pair of trucks and a long table remained in the square, left behind when the inductions were complete. He took up the radio again.
Sister, can you hear me?
Sister Peg was waiting by the hatch.
Yes, Lieutenant.
I'm not sure, but I think something's going on out here.
A pause.
Thank you for telling me, Lieutenant Jackson.
He clipped the radio to his belt. His grip on his rifle tightened reflexively. Though he knew a round was seated in the chamber, he gently drew back the charging handle to double-check. Through the tiny window, the brass casing gleamed. The radio crackled. Hollis.
Caleb, come back.
What have you got?
Something's out there.
Caleb's heart accelerated.
Where?
Headed for the square, northwest corner.
Caleb pressed the binoculars to his brow again. With vexing slowness, the square came into focus.
I'm not seeing anything.
It was there a second ago.
Still scanning, Caleb lifted the radio to his mouth to call the command platform.
Station 1, this is Station 9.
He stopped in mid-sentence. His vision had grazed something. He swept the lenses back the way they'd come. The table in the square had been overturned. Behind it, the nose of one of the trucks was pointed upward at a 45-degree angle, its rear wheels sunk deep into the earth. A sinkhole. A big one, opening up. Peter turned away from the battlefield. The buildings of the city were shapes against the dark, lit by angled moonlight. Chase was beside him.
What is it?
The feeling prickled his skin like static electricity. All eyes.
There's something we're not seeing.
He held up a hand.
Hang on. Did you hear that?
Hear what?
Apgar's eyes narrowed as he cocked his head.
Wait.
Yeah.
Like rats inside walls.
I hear it too, Chase said.
Peter grabbed the mic.
Station 6, anything out there?
Nothing.
Station 6, report!
Sister Peg stepped into the kitchen pantry. The rifle was stashed on the top shelf, wrapped in oilcloth. It had belonged to her brother, rest his soul. He had served with the expeditionary years ago. She remembered the day the soldier had arrived at the orphanage with the news of his death. He had brought her brother's locker of effects. Nobody had checked the contents, or else the rifle would have been taken back into inventory. Or so Sister Peg had supposed at the time. Most of the belongings in her brother's locker contained no trace of him, and did not seem worth keeping. But not his gun. Her brother had held it, used it, fought with it. It stood for what he was. It was more than a remembrance. It was a gift, as if he'd left it behind so that someday she would have it when she needed it. She moved the ladder into place and with gingerly steps brought the gun down and placed it on the table where the sisters needed bread. Sister Peg had cared for the weapon meticulously. The action was tight and well lubed. She liked the way it fired, with a decisive trigger and a good, clean snap. Once a year, in May, the month of her brother's death, Sister Peg would remove her frock, don the clothes of an ordinary worker, and take the transport out to the orange zone. The rifle rode beside her, concealed in a duffel bag. Beyond the windbreak, she would set up a target of cans, sometimes apples or a melon, or sheets of marked paper nailed to a tree.
She carried the rifle, now loaded, to the dining hall. Over the years, the gun had grown heavier in her arms, but she could still manage it, including the recoil, which was dampened by a buffer tube with a spring connected to the pad. This was very important for follow-up shots. She chose a position by the hatch with a clear view of the hallway and the windows on either side of the room. She thought she should take a moment to pray, but as she was holding a loaded rifle, conventional prayer did not seem entirely suitable. Sister Peg hoped that God would help her, but it was her belief that he much preferred for people to attend to themselves. Life was a test. It was up to you to pass it or not. She raised the gun to her clavicle and angled one eye down the length of the barrel. "Not my children," she said, and pulled the charging handle, snapping the first round into the chamber. "Not tonight."
"Rider inbound!"
A tense new energy shivered along the rampart. Something was shifting. The viral barrier parted, forming a corridor like the one the previous night. Down this hallway, a single rider galloped toward them. All along the catwalk, eyes took purchase upon the posts and slots of gun sights. Gathering pressure flowed from shoulders to forearms to the padded tips of index fingers. The order to hold fire was clear, yet the urge to do otherwise was strong. Still the rider kept on coming. Raised in the saddle, this person, the gender was as yet unknowable, was yelling incomprehensible words. While one hand clutched the reins, the other swayed in the air over the rider's head, a gesture of ambiguous meaning. Was it a threat? A plea for forbearance? On the command platform, Peter understood what was about to happen. The inductees had no experience. They lacked the mental muscle memory of military training. They existed in only the most general way within a chain of command. The second Alicia reached the lighted perimeter, he would lose control of the situation.
"Hold your fire!" he was yelling. "Don't shoot!"
But words went only so far. Alicia hit the lighted perimeter at a full gallop.
"It's a trap!"
Her words made no sense to him. She pulled up, skidding to a halt.
"It's a trap! They're inside!"
A shout came from Peter's left.
"It's that woman from last night! She's a viral! Shoot her!"
The first bullet speared Alicia's right thigh, shattering her femur. The second caught her in the left lung. The horse's front legs folded, sending her pitching forward over its neck. The first pops became a full-throated barrage. Dust kicked up around her as she crawled behind the fallen animal, which now lay riddled and dead. Shots were connecting. Bullets were finding their mark. Alicia experienced them like a fusillade of punches. Her left palm speared like an apple, the ilium of her right pelvis shrapnelized like an exploding grenade. Two more to the chest, the second of which ricocheted off her fourth rib, plunged diagonally through her thoracic cavity, and cracked her second lumbar vertebrae. She did her best to shove herself beneath the fallen horse. Blood splashed from its flesh as the bullets pounded.
"Lost," she thought, as a curtain of darkness fell. "Everything is lost."
The majority of virals emerged inside the city at four points: the central square, the southeast corner of the impoundment, a large sinkhole in H-Town, and the staging area inside the main gate. Others had piloted their way through the pocketed earth to emerge in smaller pods throughout the city. The floors of houses, abandoned lots, weedy and untended where children had once played. The streets of densely packed neighborhoods. They dug and crawled. They traced the sewage and water lines. They were clever. They sought the weakest points. For months they had moved through the geological and man-made fissures beneath the city, like an infestation of ants.
"Go now," their master ordered. "Fulfill your purpose. Do that which I've commanded."
On the catwalk, Peter did not have long to consider Alicia's words of warning. Amid the roar of guns, many of the soldiers, gripped by the frenzy of a mob, were firing upon the dopeys as well. The structure lurched under him. It was as if the metal grate beneath his feet were a carpet that had been lifted and shaken at one end. The sensation shot to his stomach, a swirl of nausea, like seasickness. He looked side to side, searching for the source of this motion, simultaneously becoming aware that he was hearing screams. A second lurch, and the structure jolted downward. His balance failed. Knocked backward, he fell to the floor of the catwalk. Guns were blasting, voices yelling. Bullets whizzed over his face.
"The gate!" someone cried. "They're opening the gate! Shoot them! Shoot those fuckers!"
A groan of bending metal, and the catwalk began to tip away from the wall. He was rolling toward the edge. He had no way to stop himself. His hands found nothing to grab. Bodies tumbled past, launching into the dark. As he rolled over the lip, one hand seized slick metal, a support strut. His body swung around it like a pendulum. He would not be able to hold on. He had merely paused. Beneath him, the city spun, lit with screams and gunfire.
"Take my hand."
It was Jock. He had launched himself under the rail, one arm dangling over the edge. The catwalk had paused at a 45-degree angle to the ground.
"Grab on!"
A series of pops. The last bolts were yanking free of the wall. Jock's fingertips, inches from Peter's, could have been a mile away. Time was moving in two streams. There was one, of noise and haste and violent action, and a second, coincidental with the first, in which Peter and everything around him seemed caught in a lazy current. His grip was failing. His other hand flailed uselessly, trying to grasp Jock's.
"Pull yourself up!"
Peter tore away.
"I've got you!"
Jock was gripping him by the wrist. A second face appeared under the rail. Apgar. As the man reached down, Jock heaved Peter upward. Apgar caught him by the belt. Together they hauled him the rest of the way. The catwalk began to fall. The slaughter had commenced. Freed from hiding, the virals poured over the city. They swarmed the ramparts, flinging men into space. They launched from the ground and rooftops like a glowing fireworks display. They burst through the floors of hard boxes to butcher the occupants and exploded through the floors of buildings to haul the hiding inhabitants from closets and out from under their beds. They stormed the gate, which, although formidable, was not designed to repel an attack from within. All that was required to open the city to invasion was to tear the crossbars from their braces, free the brake, and push. The pod that emerged near the impoundment was likewise charged with a specific mission. Throughout the day, their delicate sensorium had detected the footfalls of a great number of people, all headed in the same direction. They had heard the roar of vehicles and the barks of bullhorns. They had heard the word "damn." They had heard the word "shelter." They had heard the word "tubes." Those that sought a direct entry to the dam were confounded. As Chase had predicted, there was no way in. Others, like an elite assault force, homed in on a compact building nearby. This was guarded by a small contingent of soldiers, who died swiftly and badly. Jaws snapping, fingers trilling, eyes restlessly roaming, the virals took measure of the interior. The room was full of pipes. Pipes meant water. Water meant the dam. A flight of stairs descended. They arrived in a hallway with walls of sweating stone. A ladder took them deeper underground, a second deeper still. A dense humanity lay near. They were coming closer. They were homing in. They reached a metal door with a heavy ring. The first viral, the Alpha, opened the door and slid inside, the others following. The room was ripe with the odor of men. A row of lockers, a bench, a table bearing the remains of a hastily abandoned meal. Connected to a complex assembly of pipes and gears was a panel with six steel wheels the size of manhole covers.
"Yes," said Zero. "Those."
The Alpha gripped the first wheel. Inlet number one, it was marked.
"Turn it."
Six wheels, six tubes, 800 dying cries. Pistol extended, Sarah approached the storage room and gently dislodged the door with her foot.
"Maybe it was just mice,"
Jenny whispered. The scratching sounded again. It was coming from behind a stack of crates. Sarah placed the lantern on the floor and pushed the pistol out with both hands. The crates were piled four high. One on the bottom began to move, jostling those above it.
"Sarah?"
The crates went tumbling. Sarah fell back as the viral burst through the floor, twisting in midair to attach itself to the ceiling like a roach. She fired the pistol blindly. The viral seemed not to care at all about the gun, or else knew that Sarah was too startled to aim. The pistol's slide locked back. The magazine was spent. Sarah turned, shoved Jenny from the room, and began to run. At the base of the wall, Alicia, immobilized, broken, lay alone. Her breathing was labored and damp, punctuated by small, exquisitely painful hitches. Blood was in her mouth. Her vision seemed skewed. Images refused to resolve. She had no sense of time at all. She might have been shot 30 seconds ago. It might have been an hour. A dark shape materialized above her. Soldier, bowing his head to hers. "Oh, see what you've done to yourself," he said. "I leave you for a minute and look what happens." His warm breath kissed her face. He dipped closer, nuzzling her, exhaling softly through his nostrils.
"My good boy."
She raised one bloody hand to his cheek.
"My great, my magnificent soldier. I am sorry."
"Sister, what have they done to you?"
Amy was kneeling beside her. The woman's shoulders shook with a sob. She buried her face in her hands.
"Oh, no," she moaned. "Oh, no."
The spotlights had gone out. Alicia heard gunshots and cries, but these were distant, dimming. A merciful darkness enveloped her. Amy was holding her hand. It seemed that all that had gone before was a journey, that the road had brought her here and ended. The night slid into silence. She felt suddenly cold. She drifted away. "Wait." Her eyes flew open. A breeze was pushing over her, dense, gritty, and with it a rumble, like thunder, though the sound did not stop. It rolled and rolled, its volume accumulating, the air swirling with wind-blown matter. The ground beneath them began to shake. With a whinny, Soldier reared up, his hooves slashing the air.
"Her army is nothing. I can whisk it away."
Alicia raised her head just in time to see them coming. Peter, Apgar, and Jock were racing down the fallen catwalk. Its failure proceeded in sections, like dominoes falling in a line. Peter's orders to fall back to the orphanage, the city's last line of defense, went unheeded. A state of panic reigned. The problem was not merely the serial collapse of the catwalk, from which soldiers were falling 100 feet to their deaths. The virals had also stormed its length. Some men were hurled, others devoured, twitching and screaming as the virals' jaws sank home. Yet a third group were bitten and subsequently left to their own devices. As had been witnessed in the townships,
Fanning's virus did its work with unprecedented swiftness. In short order, a growing percentage of Kerrville's defenders were turning on their former comrades. 100 yards downstream from the vanished command post, Peter, Apgar, and Jock found themselves boxed in. Behind them, the catwalk's failure continued span by span. Ahead, the virals were coming toward them. No flight of stairs lay within reach.
"Oh, hell," said Apgar. "I always hated doing this."
They unfurled the ropes over the side. Jock was no fan of heights either. The incident on the mission roof had scarred him for life. Yet it was also true that in the last 24 hours, a change had occurred. He had always believed himself to be a flimsy man, a chip in the current of life. But since the birth of his son, and the burst of love this had produced, he had discovered within himself a solidity of character he had never thought possible, an expanding sense of life's importance and his place within its web. He wanted to be a man of whom it could be said that he had put others before himself and died in their defense. Thus, the newly inducted and personally transformed Private Jock Alvado shoved his terror aside, stepped over the rail, and turned his back on the maw of space below him. Peter and Apgar did the same. They jumped. 100 feet, with only the friction of their hands and feet to slow them, they landed hard on the packed dirt. Peter and Apgar came up quickly, but Jock did not. He had sprained, perhaps broken his ankle. Peter pulled him upright and threw the man's arm over his shoulder.
"Christ, you're heavy!"
They ran. The basement was a death trap. As Sarah ran for the door, a scream volleyed behind her, sharp, like metal being cut. Then the room erupted in cries. She was carrying a little girl. She had scooped her up without thinking. She would have carried more if she could. She would have carried them all. Jenny reached the door first. People were surging behind her. Suddenly, the woman couldn't move. The weight of panicked bodies had immobilized her, pressing her against the metal. She was yelling for people to back away, but could scarcely be heard. The shrieks of the children were like the highest notes of a scale, impossibly shrill. The door burst open. 100 people attempted to cram through at once. Blind instinct had taken hold. To flee, to survive whatever the cost. People were falling, children being trampled underfoot. Virals ricocheted around the room, flinging themselves from wall to wall, victim to victim. Their enjoyment was obscene. One was carrying a child in its mouth and shaking it like a dog with a rag doll. As Sarah wedged through the door, a faceless woman wrenched the little girl from her arms and shoved ahead, knocking her to the floor at the base of the stairs. People were thundering past. A familiar face emerged from the chaos. Grace, holding her baby. She was huddled against the wall of the stairwell. Upstairs, guns were popping. Sarah gripped the woman by the sleeve to make her look at her. "Stay with me. Hold my hand." Jenny and Hannah were waving to her from the top of the stairs. Sarah half pulled, half dragged Grace to the lobby. Beyond the doors, a fierce battle raged. Children were screaming. Mothers were huddled with their children. No one knew where to go. A few were running blindly out the door, into the heart of it. The virals were behind them and coming up the stairs. A huge crash. The front of the building detonated inward. Bricks, shards of glass, splintered plywood went flying. Suddenly, an Army 5-ton was standing in the lobby. Hollis was at the wheel.
"Everybody get in!"
Amy covered Alicia's body with her own. Her army was dying. She felt them leaving her, souls draining into the ether.
"You did not fail me," she thought. "It was I who erred. Go peacefully. At last, you are free."
Fanning's virals broke through. Amy buried her face against Alicia's neck, holding her close. It would happen quickly, faster than light. She thought of Peter. Then, of nothing at all. It felt as if they were inside a flock of birds, as if the air around them had turned into a million flapping wings. From the roof of the orphanage, Caleb watched the city die. He had heard the catwalk collapse, a terrific crash. The scene before him possessed an odd quality of disconnection. It was as if he were observing events that did not wholly pertain to him, unfolding at a great remove. Though when the shooting started, he knew, he would feel differently. 25 men. How long could they last? The gunshots faded, the flash of fired rounds, the pitiable, anguished screams. The city was sliding into silence, a place of ghosts. A moment of stunning quiet. Then a new sound accumulated. Caleb pressed his eyes to the binoculars. An army 5-ton, draped in canvas, was roaring toward them from the square, flanked by a pair of Humvees. The men on the turrets were firing wildly, others shooting through the windows of the cab. Simultaneously, Caleb became aware of a second, more compact movement to his right. He swung his lenses around. Impenetrable darkness. Then two figures appeared. A third man was being carried. Apgar. His father. They would intersect with the truck near the front of the building. Caleb's feet barely touched the ladder as he descended. One of the Humvees veered away from the other vehicles. Virals were clinging to it. It crashed onto its side and began to roll, like an animal trying to shake off a swarm of hornets. The 5-ton was moving too quickly. It was going to crash into the building. At the last second, the driver cut the wheel to the left and screeched to a stop. Hollis leapt from the cab, Sarah from the bed. Everyone was grabbing children and hauling them through the door. Caleb vaulted over the sandbags and raced toward his father and the general. "Take him," his father said. Caleb threaded an arm around the injured man's back. The situation took shape in Caleb's mind. The orphanage would be their final stand. In the dining room, Sister Peg waited by the open hatch. The woman was holding a rifle. The sight was so odd that Caleb's mind simply rejected it. "Hurry," Sister Peg yelled. His father and Apgar were ordering men to take positions at the windows. Hands reached up through the opening in the floor to help the children, who funneled into the hatch with a slowness painfully out of sync with everything else that was occurring. People were pushing and shoving, women screaming, babies crying. Caleb smelled gasoline. An empty fuel can lay on its side on the floor, a second by the pantry door. Their presence made no sense. It was in the same category of unaccountable details as Sister Peg's rifle. Men were hurling dining chairs through the windows. Others were upending tables to act as barricades. All the things of the world were colliding. Caleb took a position at the closest window, pointed his rifle into the darkness, and began to fire. For Peter Jackson, last president of the Texas Republic, the final seconds of the night were nothing he had anticipated. Once the catwalk had begun its collapse and the nature of the situation had become clear to him, he wholly intended to die. This was the only honorable outcome he could foresee. Amy was gone. His friends were gone. The city was gone. And he had only himself to blame. Surviving Kerrville's destruction would be an unthinkable disgrace. The last of the civilians had descended through the hatch. But would the door hold? Judging from the events of the last 10 minutes, Peter could only conclude that, like everything else, it was bound to fail. Fanning, however he'd done it, knew everything. Still, one had to try. Symbolism counted for something, as Apgar had said. The virals were amassing outside. They would storm the building as a horde. Still firing from the window, Peter ordered the men to fall back to the shelter. They had nothing left to defend except themselves. Many were out of ammo anyway. A final shot from Peter's rifle, and the charger locked back. He cast the gun aside and drew his pistol. "Mr. President, time to go." Apgar was standing behind him.
I thought you were calling me Peter now. I mean it. You need to get down that hole right now.
Peter squeezed off around. Maybe he connected, maybe not.
I'm not going anywhere.
Peter would never be sure what Apgar had hit him with. The butt of his pistol, the leg of a broken chair, a thud at the back of his skull, and his legs melted, followed by the rest of him.
Caleb, he heard Apgar say, help me get your father out of here.
His body lacked all volition. His thoughts were like slick ice, impossible to hold. He was being dragged, then lifted, then lowered once again. He felt oddly like a child, and this feeling morphed into a memory, an impossible memory, in which he was a little boy again. Not merely a boy, but an infant, being passed from hand to hand. He saw faces above him. They floated enormously, their features bloated and vague. He was being laid upon a wooden platform. A single face came into focus. His son's. But Caleb wasn't a boy anymore. He was a man, and the situation had reversed. Caleb was the father and he the son. Or so it seemed. It was a pleasant inversion, inevitable in its way. And Peter felt happy that he had lived long enough to see this. It's all right, Dad, Caleb said. You're safe now. And then the light went out. Apgar slammed the hatch and listened as the bolts sealed from inside.
You could have gone, said Sister Peg.
So could you. He rose and looked at her. Everything felt suddenly calm. The gas was a good idea.
I thought so, too.
Ready? Sounds above. The virals were tearing through the roof. Apgar lifted a rifle from the floor, checked the magazine, and shoved it back into the well. Sister Peg withdrew the box of matches from the pocket of her tunic. She struck one, tossed it. A river of blue flames snaked along the floor, then separated, running in several directions.
Shall we?
Apgar said. They walked briskly down the hall. Thick smoke was boiling up. At the door, they halted.
You know, said Sister Peg, I think I'll stay after all.
His eyes searched her face.
I think it's best this way, she explained, to be with them.
Of course, that's what she would want. To affirm his understanding, Apgar cupped her chin, leaned his face forward, and kissed her lightly on the lips.
Well,
she managed. Tears rose to her throat. She had never been kissed by a grown man before.
I didn't expect that.
I hope you didn't mind.
You always were a lovely boy.
That's nice of you to say. She took his hands and held them.
God bless and keep you, Gunner.
And you as well, sister. Then he was gone. She faded back into the hall. In the dining room, flames were leaping up the walls. The smoke was dense and swirling. Sister Peg began to cough. She lay down on the hatch. Her time in the physical world was ending. She had no fear of what would come, the hand of love into which her spirit would pass. Fire took the building in its grip. The flames shot up, consuming all. As the smoke snaked inside her, Sister Peg's mind filled up with faces. Faces by the hundreds, the thousands. Her children. She would be with them again. All around the building, the virals were watching. They stood in abeyance, the glow of the flames glazing their denuded faces. They had been vanquished. Fire was a barrier they could not cross. Still, they waited, ever hopeful. The hours passed. The building burned and burned and burned some more. The embers were still glowing when dawn came, a blade of light sweeping over the silent city.
10. The Exodus. To war and arms I fly. Richard Lovelace, to Lucasta, going to the wars. 73. Greer. He was dead to the world. In a different one, a voice was calling his name.
Lucius, wake up!
He jerked to consciousness. He was sitting in the cab of the tanker. Patch was standing on the running board by the open door. Through the windshield, a foggy dawn.
What time is it?
His mouth was dry.
06:30. You should have woken me up.
What do you think I just did? Greer stepped down. The water was still, birds swooping low over its glassy surface.
Anything happen while I was asleep?
Patch shrugged in his wiry way.
Nothing major. Just before sunrise, we saw a small pod working its way down the shore.
Where?
Base of the Channel Bridge.
Greer frowned.
And this didn't strike you as important?
They never came all that close. It didn't seem worth the trouble to wake you. Greer got in his truck and drove down the isthmus. Lore was standing on the dock, hands perched on her hips, studying the hull. The repair was nearing completion.
How long till we fill? He asked.
3, maybe 4 hours. She raised her voice.
Rand, watch that chain!
Where is he? Greer asked.
Quonset hut, I think.
He found Michael sitting at the shortwave.
Kerville, come back, please. This is Isthmus Station.
A momentary pause, and he repeated the call.
Anything?
Greer asked. Michael shook his head. His expression was blank, his mind far away in worry.
I have some other news. A viral pod was sighted near the bridge a while ago.
Michael turned sharply. Did they approach?
Patch says no.
Michael sat back. He rubbed his face with a heavy hand.
So they know we're here.
It would seem so. The bolts were still too hot to touch. Peter was standing on the platform just below the hatch. His mind had cleared, but his headache felt like an ice pick buried in the back of his skull.
It's got to be light out, Sarah said. What should we do?
Caleb and Hollis were there as well. Peter scanned their faces. Both wore the same expression, of weariness and defeat, the power of decision beyond them. None had slept a wink.
Wait, I guess.
An hour or so passed. Peter was dozing on the platform when he heard knocking on the hatch. He reached up to touch the surface. The metal had cooled somewhat. He removed his jersey and wrapped it around his hands. Beside him, Caleb did the same. They each took a lever and turned. Cracks of daylight appeared at the edges, and with them, a strong smell of smoke. Water dripped through. They pushed the hatch open the rest of the way. Chase was standing over them, holding a bucket. His face was black with soot. Peter climbed the ladder, the others following. They emerged into a scene of ruin. The orphanage was gone, reduced to a smoldering wreckage of ashes and collapsed beams. The heat was still intense. Behind Peter's chief of staff stood a group of 7, 3 soldiers of diverse ranks and 4 civilians, including a teenage girl and a man who had to be at least 70. All were holding buckets, their clothes sodden, arms and faces black as coal. They had wetted down a path through the ashes, clearing a way out of the destruction. The fire had leapt to several adjacent buildings, which were burning to various degrees.
It's good to see you, Mr. President.
As with everyone who had survived the night, Chase's survival was a story of luck and timing. When the catwalk had begun to fail, he had just stepped away from the command deck in search of more ammunition. This placed him near the stairs on the west side of the gate. He had made it to the bottom just in time to see the whole thing come crashing to the ground. 2 soldiers had recognized him. They'd hustled him into a truck to get him to the president's hard box, but they hadn't made it very far before they were attacked. The driver yanked through the windshield. As the vehicle rolled, Chase was thrown clear, his rifle empty and the hard